and colleagues, and welcome to Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. This is a bonus episode. This is the very first episode we ever recorded when we were feeling our way through this podcast thing. So this is demo episode number one. Fair word of warning, this one's pretty raw. I recorded it in my car with my phone, and we didn't have intro music or outro music that we had figured out yet. We talked a lot, I think. We were feeling our way, but there's still some excellent articles that we discussed and still some really good information in here. So, with your forgiveness, please enjoy.
Bum, 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 intro music, ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. Hello, friends. Welcome to demo episode number one of our dermatology podcast, which still does not have a name. The two most likely candidates are Dermstat or Dermasphere. I'm Luke Johnson, an assistant professor at the University of Utah School of Medicine. I see adults and children. I have a specialty in pediatric dermatology. And with me is my good friend and colleague,
Dr. Michelle Tarbox. I'm an assistant professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in sunny Lubbock, Texas. And I see adults and children in my practice, as well as having a focus on cosmetic dermatology and hair.
And this podcast is intended to provide up-to-date information about the latest research to practicing dermatologists and other healthcare professionals with an interest in dermatology. We don't have time to read stuff. Well, you don't have time to read stuff. We obviously did read it, or we wouldn't be doing the podcast. But our hope is that you have time to listen to it with your ears. So this is the latest dermatology research direct to your ears. So we're going to go over, I think, four articles today. I've got two, and Michelle has two. And we'll go back and forth. And this is a demo episode, so we'll have to see how it goes. So I'm going to start with an article from the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology, the JAD, from November 2018. The title is Time to Reconsider the Role of Sentinel Lymph Node Biopsy in Melanoma, by Bigby and colleagues. This is helpful for me because during residency, I learned a few things about sentinel lymph node biopsy, and the more I learned, the more the recommendations seemed to get a little bit hazy. And this is a fun international group that writes this article. It's people from Boston, Australia, Tasmania, and Romania. And as far as I can tell, they're basically saying we shouldn't do sentinel lymph node biopsies anymore. Michelle, you see more adults than I do, since I think about 70% of my practice is kids. What do you currently tell patients about sentinel lymph node biopsy?
That's a great question, and I think it's something that our understanding of its utility is still kind of evolving. So recently, we underwent a new revision of staging guidelines with the AJCC 8. And some of the recommendations based off of previous parameters sort of changed in that kind of reclassification. Still, most adult patients who have a melanoma at this point over 0.8 millimeters in depth or that is ulcerated are being referred or at least offered the option of having a sentinel lymph node biopsy. Some of that with an eye towards treatment options or potential monitoring for outcomes.
And maybe to get them into clinical trials, which is something this paper talks about.
Yeah.
So it's possible that this was written in response to those updated guidelines. So they use a lot of acronyms in this, so it's a bit difficult to parse. But there were these big trials called the Multicenter Selective Lymphadenectomy Trials that were done a decade or two ago, the MSLT trials, which I think is probably where a lot of the current recommendations come from. So this, they review these trials in this paper. So in the first one, MSLT1, they had about 1,600 patients with melanoma that were randomly assigned to get sentinel lymph node biopsy. Plus, if there were nodes were positive, they did a lymphadenectomy on all the nodes there. So that's known as immediate completion lymph node dissection, ICLD. So randomly assigned to people who got that or observation. The people who were just observed and didn't get the sentinel biopsies followed up in clinical exams. Sometimes they got ultrasounded, and if they did end up having clinically or ultrasound detected nodes than those were treated later. They were followed for 10 years, and it showed that the sentinel lymph node biopsy and the immediate completion lymph node dissection did not prolong disease-free survival. So I think that's sort of what I learned in residency. Mm-hmm. And then the MSLT2, the second one, showed that the observation groups also did well. So it was okay to follow them with clinic exam and ultrasounds, and they followed patients out for 3 years. The authors of this paper also report that lymph node biopsy and lymph node dissection obviously have some risks. I knew this, that they had some risks of lymphedema. 24% apparently is the risk of lymphedema in the patients who had the completion dissection, and 6% in just the sentinel lymph node biopsy by itself, which is still surprisingly high for just the sentinel node. So these guys say that if patients who undergo wide excision and observations are actively followed, just as they were in these trials, then they can be treated successfully with delayed lymphadenectomy, if necessary, if it's detected later clinically, without requiring what they call more extensive and mutilating surgery at the time. So that's the background, and they report that after those trials, most practitioners started to consider sentinel lymph node biopsy as primarily a staging procedure. Michelle, it sounds like that's kind of what you were talking about.
Yeah, and it's interesting, actually. The AJCC 8 guidelines sort of made a point out of the fact that micrometer readings aren't necessarily as specific as we as dermatopathologists like to believe that they are. So they emphasized that, you know, you should round to the nearest tenth of a millimeter. So anything between, you know, 0.73 to 0.84 was considered 0.8 millimeters for this particular categorization.
Did they have reasons why it's not as precise as we wish it were?
I think that they just felt that it wasn't really reasonable to expect the human eye to decipher that using an ocular micrometer, and that there's variance between different ocular micrometers and levels of calibration on different microscopes. And so they felt that it was more appropriate to have that rounded to that 0.8 figure.
Makes
which
sense.
Pushes it into the different category.
So this paper goes on about using sentinel lymph node biopsy for staging, and they make a pretty good argument that it's not a very good staging procedure. The papers apparently that originally reported it as a fairly strong staging procedure also reported that depth of the melanoma was a pretty good staging procedure too. Mm-hmm. And they also point out that sentinel lymph node status is highly correlated to Breslow thickness. So maybe we can just use histopathological and clinical characteristics of the tumor, sort of like you talked about, the depth and ulceration and whatnot, rather than having to biopsy people to kind of determine their staging and prognosis. So they report that a model that combines the clinical and pathological features of the tumor at the time of excision better predicts relapse and overall survival than sentinel lymph node status. They added the sentinel lymph node status to this model and saw that it increased the predictive power from 70% to 74%, which doesn't really seem worth it if I were the person having their lymph nodes removed. 4% yeah. Doesn't really sound good. And they also point out that one model is available on the internet that's apparently accessible to all. And they also point out that lymph node dissections aren't cheap, $14,000 to $18,000 in the U.S. So they say it shouldn't be used as a staging procedure either. Mm-hmm. And they close by saying it shouldn't be used as an entry criterion for clinical trials. So apparently a lot of clinical trials require sentinel lymph node status. And they say that because of all of their above information, the arguments that they presented before this, that we should reevaluate that if we are enrolling patients in clinical trials and just use some of these other predictors to prognosticate them.
It's going to be interesting to see how our new molecular technologies play into this new paradigm, because we have more access to understanding the genetic shifts that have caused the resultant melanoma than we ever had in the past. And predictive models are being built, or some of them are actually already in practice, to determine whether a biopsied melanoma is more or less likely to metastasize. So it will be very interesting to see what role molecular technology plays going forward with this decision point.
Yeah. You've been at this for a few years, Michelle. What would be your prediction about what role it would play?
I think our barriers to it being utilized more extensively are that there are multiple different models, all of which have strengths and weaknesses. And selecting a single model favoring one over others would have potential bias issues. So I don't know if it's going to become a general recommendation to include molecular diagnostic techniques, which would unfortunately lose some specificity and some ability to actually monitor for the resultant, you know, increase or, you know, improvement in specificity in those patients. But I do see there being a role for some form of molecular technology to help us make these hard decisions when we're taking care of our patients. When you look at the, you know, outcomes of patients that have relatively thin melanomas, which are the ones that most, you know, frequently we encounter, fortunately, in our practices, that's really one of the places where some of these technologies can help us make decisions, because very deep, very large, very ulcerated melanomas, it's going to be a less complicated decision to make whether or not one does that sentinel lymph node biopsy. But, you know, when it's a melanoma that's just breached that, you know, newly adjusted barrier, do we decide to go forward with sentinel lymph node or not? Utilizing the technologies that already exist or that are being developed might be able to help us, you know, make those decisions with less morbidity for the patients. The other question always that arises is how are we going to pay for it? So as these technologies become more recognized, there might be some ability for there to be insurance reimbursement that helps cover some of these services. I'm hoping that also competition helps bring some of the pricing down.
Makes sense. I don't have as much experience with this as you do, but from what I've seen, if a melanoma is difficult histopathologically, it seems to also be difficult with these molecular tests. It comes back borderline in both cases. Mm-hmm. But presumably they'll be further refined.
Yeah. There's been a phrase getting bandied about a little bit at our National Society meetings, which is borderline is borderline is borderline, because you start seeing that these lesions that are hard for us to characterize histopathologically, when we look at them with molecular techniques, also come back with equivocal results. Sometimes we look at them immunohistochemically and they can be confusing as well. So, you know, we are trying to thread the needle with understanding these very complex tumors that, you know, we can't always completely characterize into all good or all bad. Everything's got shades of gray in it.
Yeah, sometimes 50 shades or more.
Oh, God.
Well, maybe this tells us something about how melanoma progresses. It's good that it's out there, but I don't know. I have a hard time seeing exactly where it fits in right now, but I'm not a dermatopathologist. Anyway, the points that I thought that I was taking away from this article, I got four of them I thought I'd mention. One is that I don't know that I'll recommend sentinel lymph node biopsy to any of my melanoma patients unless they have clinically detectable nodes. Another is that I should probably check to see how good our ultrasounders do at detecting nodes. So if I'm just going to follow these patients and have them get ultrasounds for their nodes, I hope that we have people who can find them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I may advocate for including trials for new therapies, even if they hadn't had a lymph node, using the arguments in this paper. And then if another physician recommends a sentinel lymph node biopsy for one of my patients, I may just contact them and talk to them about their reasoning.
I think that sounds like a very sound thing to do. You know, patients that have been through sentinel lymph node biopsies with subsequent dissection sometimes do have relatively significant adverse outcomes related to that in terms of swelling and dysesthesia. You know, the benefit of that axillary dissection, you know, or another lymph node bed dissection has been sort of debated as of late. And so I think it's one of those things that we need to keep an eye on it to determine the value of continuing that practice.
So you said my reasoning was sound.
I think
I would say that it's ultrasound.
Ultrasound. Very nice. That's cool.
All right. That's what we got for that one.
Okay.
Michelle, you want to tell our lovely listeners about your articles?
So I have two fantastic articles, and both of them have to deal with some of our least favorite chief complaints. So one of them is the use of naltrexone in dermatologic conditions, including chronic pruritus. And the other one is delusions of parasitosis. So I'm going to start off with the use of naltrexone in dermatologic conditions, which is a great article that came out in the JAD in December of 2018 and was written by
I've never used naltrexone.
You've never what?
I've never used naltrexone, but I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead and tell us.
For sure. So written by Bridget Lee and Dr. Dirk Elston. And I thought it was a very useful article, had a lot of pearls in it. One of the first things that I think was a great takeaway point is that naltrexone can help with more than just itching. So naltrexone actually has mechanisms that can affect inflammation, cell adhesion, keratinocyte proliferation, and migration, which are parts of its effectiveness that I hadn't really fully understood in the past. And we'll get into a little bit about how that works in a second here. Naltrexone and naloxone, this is a source of frustration for my residents because I have used naltrexone in clinical practice. I have a number of patients with Haley-Haley that I manage with naltrexone and patients with other pruritic dermatoses that I use the medication for.
Again, you use it mostly for itch?
A lot of times it's for itch. It's also useful as an anti-inflammatory when you're kind of in between a rock and a hard place looking for one of those to use. But definitely has been beneficial in my patients with Haley-Haley. And a source of frustration for my residents sometimes is when they're trying to order it in our EHR, sometimes they can only find naloxone instead of naltrexone. They both are opioid antagonists, and they have very similar profiles, but naltrexone has a superior oral bioavailability as well as half-life. So if you have a choice, naltrexone might be a better one to choose and has also been more extensively studied. Another point I found was that it's not just about what you use, but how you use it. So some patients are treated with continuous blockade with high doses of naltrexone, 50 to 100 milligrams daily. And those are usually used to treat pruritus in conditions like psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, and lichen simplex chronicus. An important caveat with this high dose naltrexone is that patients need to be monitored for liver function test abnormalities and are going to be more likely to have side effects that can include GI symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, musculoskeletal complaints, headaches, and anxiety. So this is a dosing level that you have to check labs for. Conversely, low-dose naltrexone, 1 to 5 milligrams daily, can help with analgesia and anti-inflammatory effects and has been used in patients with Haley-Haley. That's the dose level that I use for my Haley-Haley patients. Also has been found to be beneficial in lichen planopilaris with some remission of both the itch and the inflammatory presenting signs of that condition, guttate psoriasis and scleroderma. Yeah, and the lichen planopilaris was something I'd heard of one time and it had fallen into the back of my head because at the time I'd been a little bit more excited about finasteride. But in practice, I've encountered patients who have not wanted to take any hormonal therapy for either very compelling reasons or just general sort of nebulous, I don't like hormones types of reasons. And naltrexone might be an attractive alternative for those patients. And the great thing about low-dose naltrexone is that laboratory monitoring is not required and that side effects are very low. Vivid dreams were one of the most commonly reported side effects, but these were told to the patients ahead of time. And actually, the vivid dream side effect was similar in the control and experimental groups. So that might have been a bit of the power of suggestion.
You're going to have vivid dreams with this medicine.
Well, that's something that they found a little bit of, but they also saw it in the control group. So I think if you tell people they're going to have vivid dreams, they might have vivid dreams.
Listeners, you're going to love this podcast.
Guys, you are going to love this podcast, and you're going to wake up smarter and better at your job.
And more attractive.
Exactly. You're going to see patients faster. It's going to be so great. So one of the nifty things that I kind of learned and sort of refreshed my knowledge of through reading this paper was that low-dose antagonism of a receptor in general can lead to proliferation of that receptor and sometimes better binding to their endogenous ligands. And so low-dose naltrexone actually causes a compensatory increase in both endogenous opioids and their receptors. So that actually increases ligand and receptor expression. So that's one of the ways that it can help with analgesia and is one of the reasons why some rheumatologists are actually using low-dose naltrexone as an analgesic for patients who have fibromyalgia. I thought that was pretty cool.
So you get more receptors.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more molecules that bind to those receptors. Wouldn't that increase your... I guess it increases your natural opioids.
Yeah, a little bit of an increase in natural opioids. So one of the fascinating things that I kind of learned through this article was that naltrexone can affect non-opioid receptors as well. And one of them is our good old friend in the TLR family. So it's a toll-like receptor, but it's toll-like receptor 4. Toll-like receptor 4 can be found on keratinocytes and macrophages. And naltrexone can antagonize that, which can actually result in decreased TNF-alpha, IL-5, and nitrous oxide. which is really kind of fascinating. So this can be sort of a poor man's anti-inflammatory in a situation where, you know, the patient might not be an appropriate candidate for more significant blockade of inflammatory mediators, or where you have a cost issue, as naltrexone tends to be relatively affordable.
Is that with the high dose or the low dose?
That's with the low dose version. The low dose version tends to have more anti-inflammatory effect than the high dose version.
And the high dose is for itch, and the low dose is for inflammation.
Yeah, the high dose is more used for pruritic conditions that, you know, it doesn't really tend to have a huge therapeutic benefit in terms of improving the manifestations of the condition. So it was used for psoriasis, lichen simplex chronicus, and atopic dermatitis. And in those conditions, it decreased the pruritus associated with them, but wasn't really having a huge effect on the inflammation. The lower dose therapies used with Hailey-Hailey, lichen planopilaris, guttate psoriasis, and scleroderma showed both anti-pruritic and anti-inflammatory effects. And one of the reasons they think that is opioid receptors are found throughout the skin, also in fibroblasts and in immune cells.
Sounds like low dose is the way to go.
I think for dermatologists in general, low dose is the way to go unless you have a patient with like intractable lichen simplex chronicus. What's really kind of cool is that the mu receptors for the opioid receptors are actually able to be bound by beta endorphin in our body, which is a naturally produced molecule. And when it is bound by beta endorphin, cytokeratin 16, which can be overexpressed in psoriasis and other proliferative disorders, can increase. So inhibition of that, even intermittent inhibition, can be helpful. Delta receptors, which is really fascinating, are at cell junctions, and they reduce desmoglein expression when they're bound to enkephalins, which is their ligand. And so overexpression of that interaction can actually cause problems with cell-cell adhesion, which makes sense for a minute why that might be beneficial for patients with Hailey-Hailey to inhibit that reaction. And overexpression can also cause dysregulation of involucrin, loricrin, and filaggrin, which we know are very important proteins to maintain the integrity of the stratum corneum. And so the ability to block that degradation is, I think, a valuable aspect of using naltrexone therapy.
So do they have advice for starting people out at 1 milligram or 5 or something else?
A lot of the different conditions had thresholds that were useful. You know, many treatment paradigms talk about starting low and increasing the dose gradually over time. And one of the reasons for that is kind of fascinating. We all know that we need to be really careful if we're starting an opioid antagonist in an opioid dependent patient. But what's really fascinating is that some of the satisfaction patients who have a chronic pruritic dermatosis get from scratching is related to endorphin release. So really? Those patients that you treat with naltrexone for chronic pruritus, even if they've not been on a systemic or oral opioid medication, can exhibit some symptoms of withdrawal. So I thought that was really fascinating. Like, it kind of makes sense, though. After I watch, like, you know, my dad scratches back on a door jam and that, like, happy look that he gets on his face, I think, you know, there might be a little endorphin release from scratching in certain circumstances. So, you know, that's kind of a fascinating thing. And then my last...
Yeah, I'm scratching my back right now and feel great.
And then my last take home from this article is that there's something called opioid growth factor receptor, which is present in the human epidermis, and it binds to opioid growth factor, and that can interact with DNA to decrease cellular proliferation. And so one of the things that imiquimod does is it actually upregulates opioid growth factor receptor, and through that mechanism inhibits cell proliferation, which may be one of the reasons why it's beneficial when you're treating proliferative conditions like perianal condylomata.
Huh.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. So do you find that you can get naltrexone covered by insurance?
I've generally been successful with it. The majority of patients that I treat with it do have Hailey-Hailey. And I have not had to fight to get it covered in those patients. Usually we are using relatively low doses. The article mentions, and I have encountered, that you do sometimes have to get creative in delivering those lower doses because some of the standard supply of naltrexone is a higher dose than you intend to use. So they mentioned that you might have to have it either prepared at a compounding pharmacy or have the patient, you know, kind of portion the medication so that they're not getting the high dose naltrexone, but I have found it to be very useful and very well tolerated by patients. They make the point in the article, and I always make the point with my residents, that you need to be really clear with the patients about how important it is that they let you know if they're using any kind of opioids, because some people are very secretive about their medications, especially those that are stigmatized, and they might not be completely forthcoming with you. And all of that really can boil down a little bit to having a good doctor-patient relationship where they trust you and they feel that they can be honest with you. But it's really important to be careful when you're soliciting that information and make sure that you really get a good list of the patient's medications, because some patients are on medicines that they don't realize are opioids. You know, so just saying, are you on any opioids? And the patient says no, doesn't mean they're not on something that they don't recognize as an opioid. So getting a good list of medications, making sure it's up to date, and verifying that they're not on opioids before starting treatment is a very important step.
That makes a lot of sense. All right, so do you usually start patients on like 1 milligram a day and see how it goes?
Most of my patients are on 5 milligrams a day. Some of my patients that are a little bit more prone to medication side effects, I'll start usually at 2.5 milligrams a day. The lichen planopilaris studies have shown good stable improvement with 3 milligram per day dosing. There's some flexibility built into that. So I think that finding the right dose for your patient can be a little bit of trial and error, but fortunately with the low dose regimen, there's pretty minimal side effects.
All right. And it stops hair loss and lichen
planopilaris? It improves the inflammation and decreases the recession of the hairline. So yeah, so if I'll take that. That's a win. With lichen planopilaris, just holding your battleground is a win.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Naltrexone. All right, I got one more. This is from the journal Acta Dermatovenereologica. I'll probably get better at saying that.
It's a callback to our origins as venereologists. One of my favorite articles that I ever got to work on with a resident was talking about the importance of syphilis in the origin of our specialty. And, you know, I think we all love syphilis a little bit more than other physicians because it's so important to our specialty being what it is.
Right. Venereologists. Those were the good old days. But now we do studies like this one about the prevalence of atopic dermatitis and chronic spontaneous urticaria are associated with parental socioeconomic status in adolescents in China. I don't know if I should attempt to pronounce the names of the authors because they're Chinese and I'm not, but I think it's Xiao and colleagues. So this was a fairly straightforward study where they got a bunch of college kids who were just enrolling in college, and then everybody who consented, which was like 98% of them, got a dermatology exam, and then they just checked the point prevalence of various conditions, and they also had these students fill out a questionnaire that, among other things, included their socioeconomic status. And so through this, they were able to associate two conditions, atopic dermatitis and chronic spontaneous urticaria, with increased socioeconomic status.
Okay.
And tinea, of all kinds, was associated with lower socioeconomic status.
Okay.
So the tinea, I would kind of guess, and then the atopic dermatitis, I feel like this study lends a little bit more fuel to this hygiene hypothesis. Mm-hmm. But they don't even mention the word hygiene in this article, so I'm not sure if they feel the same way or not. But a couple other interesting points that came out was that the point prevalence of atopic dermatitis was significantly lower than that we normally hear cited in studies. So in the past, you hear that atopic dermatitis is 10% of the population or something along those lines. And I certainly see a ton of it in my pediatric clinics. But in this study, it was 2.7%. Now this is diagnosed just skin exam, see some atopic dermatitis, boom. So it's probable that there's more people who have it that just didn't have any active lesions at the time. Though their 2.7% was dermatitis/eczema, which was divided into atopic dermatitis, which is only 1.7%, as well as neurodermatitis, I'm not sure I know what that is, allergic contact dermatitis, photosensitive dermatitis, and other dermatitis. So a bit unusual. Psoriasis and vitiligo were also significantly lower than the prevalences that we hear. We hear 1 to 2% of the population, and they had 0.1% for psoriasis and 0.2% for vitiligo. And then only 0.6% of their patients had a wart, which seems surprisingly low to me. Maybe I just see a ton of warts where I am. And maybe things are different in China. They're less warty over there. I did wonder if your average 18-year-old enrolling in college knows their parents' income. So that's a big way that they checked the socioeconomic status. It was level of parental education and then income. And geez, I didn't know my parents' income when I was enrolling in college.
Yeah, me neither.
Do you know your parents' income now? You want to tell the listeners?
My parents are retired, so.
So not too good. A couple other just eye-opening things. They divided the per capita annual income into U.S. dollars, and the low range was less than $800 per person, and the highest range was over $6,000 per person, which is all way lower than it is in the United States, so take that for what it's worth. They also found that students who are going into engineering in general had a lower socioeconomic status. Who knows? And then they posit that your socioeconomic status could be associated with other factors that are more directly associated with this tendency toward atopic dermatitis and stuff. And one that they mentioned was maternal smoking, which I think makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think smoking is associated with lower socioeconomic status and also an increased risk of things like atopic dermatitis. So, things I took out of this is that atopic dermatitis is not as common as I thought, at least in a random 18-year-old Chinese student. acne was more common than I expected. It's pretty prevalent, but 10%, that's a lot. And then I thought a little bit more fuel for the hygiene hypothesis.
Cool, yeah, I agree. I think
that's what I got.
That's what you got for that one. Awesome. That gives
one
me
to go then.
Yeah, that gives me lots of time to talk about our everyone's favorite topic, delusions of parasitosis. So I'm reviewing now an excellent article that was published in the JAD in December. The authors were Dr. Elliot Campbell, Dirk Elston, James Hawthorne, and David Beckert. And it's a great discussion of this challenging condition and a very informative look at ways that we as dermatologists might potentially help treat patients who otherwise might lack access to care. One of the neat things that I found in the article, you might know that one of the synonyms for delusions of parasitosis is Ekbom syndrome. Dr. Carl Axel Ekbom was a German dermatologist who coined the term Dermatozoonvan, which means delusions of parasitosis is the actual translation, but if you break the words down, von is delusion, and dermatozoon is like things having to do with dermatology. And so he described patients who had this delusional belief that they had parasites infesting their skin. This problem dates back farther than that, of course. The actual term delusions of parasitosis came into general use from a publication in 1946 in the Archives of Dermatology and Syphilology. It was still called that back then, where they coined the phrase delusions. Good old syphilis keeps coming back. We can't get far from it. But it was also referred to as acarophobia. And usually we don't use the phrase Ekbom syndrome to describe delusions of parasitosis because that physician also described restless leg syndrome. And so sometimes restless leg syndrome is also referred to as Ekbom syndrome.
One disease, just one.
One disease. It confuses, except unless your last name is Yadison, then you get to name everything. So, right. So one thing that I thought was useful here is that they go into discussion about the fact that basically Morgellons is a type of delusions of parasitosis, but not all delusions of parasitosis patients have Morgellons disease because right. That refers Morgellons specifically.
I think there are threads coming out of my skin.
The perception of fibers or threads emerging from the skin or attached to the skin. And so that can be, you know, kind of a differentiating point, making sure we're using this terminology correctly. The DSM-5 actually made some changes to how we classify delusions of parasitosis. And this is something I didn't realize because I've definitely, by DSM-4 criteria, I was misidentifying people with delusions of parasitosis because the DSM-4 required that patients have non-bizarre delusions. But I have definitely treated patients who thought that their parasites were of extraterrestrial origin or had been unleashed as a bioterrorism agent. And so the DSM-5 removed the requirement that the delusions be non-bizarre. And we also, the requirements are that the delusions have to be present for at least a month. The patient has not met criteria for schizophrenia and that they're basically functioning outside of the delusion. You also want to exclude things like substance-induced disorders, specifically with amphetamines, dopamine agonists, opioids, topiramate, which was a kind of a surprise to me that topiramate was specifically isolated there, or cocaine. Cocaine was not a surprise. Yeah. Or other disorders.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I have to remind myself of that when I have a patient with one of these conditions to make sure I ask them about illicit drug use.
I've had several that have been using their own or other people's amphetamines, and that it's definitely played a role for those patients. One thing they brought forward is that there's a 3-to-1 ratio of women to men with delusions of parasitosis, and I will say that in my personal experience, that has been true. And that past or comorbid psychiatric conditions were reported in about 60% of patients, most commonly depression, followed by substance abuse and anxiety. There's sometimes an instigating event for patients who develop delusions of parasitosis, where they have been exposed to either a dirty environment, or sometimes they've had a risky sexual encounter that they believe to be the origin of the infestation. One of my attendings used to refer to that as GPS. Stands for guilty something syndrome, and relates to people becoming sort of obsessed with the idea that they've caught something. And so some patients might present after an event like that. They emphasize that elderly patients with scabies can have atypical presentations. They may lack burrows. So, you know, in elderly patients, don't just write off that this person has delusions of parasitosis. And in fact, the most common age for delusions of parasitosis patients to present was sort of in the middle of life, in the 50s, 40s age range. Something I've personally seen in a patient that was diagnosed with delusions of parasitosis and that they emphasize here is that one of the causes of occult parasitosis can be avian mite dermatitis. And that this can arise from contact with birds or rodents, pet hamsters or gerbils. But there can be unusual sources for this, such as natural fillings in pillows or mattresses or coats. In the patient that I was taking care of, they had an office building that had been poorly maintained and the roofs had been taken over by birds. And so they actually had huge groups of birds living in their ceiling right above where this person worked. And like things were coming through the ceiling tiles, like actual visible debris. And so this patient had mite-associated dermatitis.
Wouldn't somebody with mite-associated dermatitis have some kind of primary skin lesion?
Well, they're all excoriated is the problem. So, and mites are very, very tiny. You can find them sometimes. I'm part of a DermPath kind of WhatsApp group where we sometimes send pictures to each other and be like, what do you think is this? You know, and somebody got a great photograph of a dust mite. Those things look like the predator had a baby. And it is a mite because there are so many appendages coming off of that thing. And that is one point they make in the article, is that you might need to employ the expertise of an entomologist if you are able to isolate any of these mites. You might need to, get the help of an entomologist to figure out what mites you might have. Another good point they made is that fiberglass contaminated clothing, if it's placed in the laundry, can actually cause a whole family to itch. I've accidentally done that to my family, so I understand how that can happen. They recommend for lab workup a CBC, CMP, TSH, and then a skin biopsy with or without DIF. That's a good idea for a screening test to figure out if patients maybe have an occult anemia, if they have abnormal liver or kidney function, as those can cause generalized pruritus. And there's this thing that they talk about in theater called the slouch towards narrative, which is that human beings are programmed to make stories that make things make sense to them. And so if you see an old woman sitting alone by herself at a table with one bowl and stark lighting, and somebody asks you to tell them a story, tell them what they see, they'll tell you, oh, she's been abandoned by her family or something. They'll make up a story, but then they'll keep saying, tell me what you see. And what you see is a person sitting at a table by themselves. So we tend to make these stories up to explain things. And this happens to patients that have chronic pruritus from causes such as renal disease or bad hepatitis. I've had definitely more than one patient that has had hepatitis C that has had delusions of parasitosis along with that condition as a way for them to explain their chronic pruritus to themselves. And so, I really think... Go ahead.
The lab work they recommended again was CBC, LFTs, thyroid, and definitely a skin biopsy.
They did recommend a skin biopsy to help exclude other causes of itching, also potentially to give some insight as to what the primary process, if any, at hand there might be. The DIF was a plus-minus recommendation, I think, taking into consideration the cost of that procedure. One fascinating...
That's for, like, urticarial BP or something?
Yeah, for urticarial BP, potentially for dermatitis or piriformis, if you aren't able to identify any intact vesicles, which you usually aren't. Okay. You know, things like that. IgA pemphigus. But I think that under the correct circumstances, that could be helpful. Fascinatingly, they recommended examining vacuum bag contents, which I thought was above and beyond. I was like, you guys are brave. So they make the point that if you do examine these things, putting the kind of debris in a suspension of alcohol can be helpful because the mites will float on top if there are mites present. And the debris will sink to the bottom. So inorganic debris doesn't tend to float in that circumstance.
That is a little bit above and beyond. Good job, authors.
I think so, too. So they talk about, you know, how you approach these patients. And, you know, delusions are difficult to deal with because they're fixed. So direct confrontation is not likely to be successful. But you also don't want to be the person that they've decided believes them and they hold on to for the rest of their condition, saying, well, this doctor said that they saw a mite, or this doctor said that I have bugs, because that definitely happens. There are patients that kind of latch on to the person that agrees with them, and in a way that can become an obstacle to them getting the kind of help that they might need. So, you know, they recommend sort of a supportive kind of a supportive discussion where you might say something like, I believe you're really suffering, and I would like to help you.
That has been my approach, but I can't say it's been universally successful.
I don't think anything is universally successful in this particular patient population. I know that, you know, a lot of them have felt marginalized and felt like they have not been believed. And you know, more than one of them has probably been called crazy at some point. They actually address dealing with that in the article, where they say patients might ask you a question like, do you think I'm crazy? And, you know, you might reply to that, you know, has someone told you that you were crazy? You know, or what would it mean if you were, you know, something to kind of open up a discussion with that. In my experience, delusions of parasitosis patients, especially at the first visit, can be very, very time consuming. And it can be difficult to know coming into the encounter that the person has these delusions. So I have worked with my referring physicians to ask them, if you know you're sending me a patient that believes they have bugs, please be clear with me about that. I will see them, but I need to put them at the right place in my schedule so that I can take care of my other patients. Because I think all of us have experienced trying to take care of one of these patients in the middle of a busy clinic. And it's difficult because if you leave them in the room too long, they start to get a little bit often paranoid or concerned that, you know, their concerns either not being taken seriously or that something nefarious is happening to them. So leaving them in the room and just moving on with your day until you have time to see them is not always a good option. So for me, working with the referring physicians and trying really to get them to be clear about this so that we can get the right time slot for these patients has been helpful, but there's no bulletproof formula. How do you deal with it?
I haven't run into enough of them that I need to ask their referring providers to be sure. I just try to do it in as quickly and as kind a manner as possible.
I think that kindness is like a really important thing to focus on taking care of these patients. One thing you do have to be very careful about with them, though, of course, is boundaries, because some of the patients do have some comorbid psychiatric disorders and might have boundary issues in terms of repetitive phone calls, especially when they're feeling like they're being attacked by the parasites or having a paroxysm of itching that won't go away. And so giving them a toolkit to deal with that can also be helpful, which they sort of address here in the article, talking about, first of all, like low risk things that might be helpful, including topical antipruritics such as camphor, menthol, or pramoxine to help relieve the dysesthesias. They bring up the possibility, if the patient has comorbid obsessive compulsive disorder, of using N-acetylcysteine to help decrease skin picking. I think that can be especially helpful if your patient is a trophy keeper. Huh. So I have had patients that have brought, you know, the photo albums that have the laminated sticky sheets with like dated, you know, time collections of different skin debris. And over time, that becomes quite a part of their routine. And naltrexone, and N-acetylcysteine can potentially be helpful for those patients. It's a good idea to think about. I wonder if naltrexone could help. There might be some endogenous opioid release caused by the skin picking. Interesting idea.
Sounds like naltrexone is good for everything.
I know. We can think about that. So they mentioned what we all basically learned that, you know, in our textbooks, pimazide is always going to be listed as that first line agent. But there are a lot of barriers to using it, one of them being that an ECG is usually recommended, an electrocardiogram, to measure the QT interval, and that there is a risk for cardiovascular events with pimazide. And the sort of crux of this article is that delusions of parasitosis can be effectively managed with second-generation antipsychotics, which they recommended most strongly risperidone at a dose of 0.5 to 4 milligrams a day as first-line therapy for patients with recalcitrant delusions of parasitosis. Now, they have some fantastic tables in this article that list the side effects of the different antipsychotic agents. And one of the side effects that I needed to get a little bit more information about, because, you know, I thought I pretty much understood what it meant, but I wasn't 100% sure, was the side effect of akathisia. And so akathisia is derived from the Greek inability to sit still. The patients can't sit still. So it's muscle quivering, restlessness. They want to jump out of their skin. And this is a side effect that can sometimes be worse than the thing it's prescribed to treat, that the medication is prescribed to treat. So it's something to be aware of, the percentage of patients that develop that side effect. And interestingly, with pimazide, which is listed as our, you know, first line therapy agent, the kind of total event rate and attributal risk for akathisia was 40%, which is pretty darn high. Risperidone, that risk goes down to 10 and 7%. So much more acceptable side effect profile with the, you know.
10% still seems high.
It's not low. These medicines, you got to put your big boy pants on to use these medicines, is definitely true. They do recommend before starting any of the second generation antipsychotics that you would check baseline lipids, fasting glucose, hemoglobin A1C, because all of them can cause varying degrees of metabolic changes, with olanzapine being the greatest culprit with that, with more than 40.6% total event rate for weight gain above 7% from baseline. So, and that is a side effect that most patients complain about.
If you have a patient with delusional parasitosis and you're planning to start one of these, the labs you should check, including the ones we mentioned earlier, are CBC, LFTs, thyroid, skin biopsy.
And then just specifically for the antipsychotics, baseline lipids, fasting glucose, hemoglobin A1C.
Okay.
The least likely medicine to cause weight gain was aripiprazole. I always say that one wrong. So aripiprazole. So that was the medication that had the least significant risk for weight gain. Some of the patients that you treat for this condition might be very adverse to a medication that might cause weight gain as a side effect. So that's something people are very sensitive to. And then they're very good at listing also the side effect kind of overlaps that these different medicines have, but focusing on, you know, which ones are a little bit lower risk. And the one that comes out on top basically is the winner is risperidone as the first line, with the alternate first line being aripiprazole. There's a great table that talks about the potential drug interactions with all of these. Most of them are going to be inducers or inhibitors of the CYP enzymes in the liver. Antihypertensives can be a problem with aripiprazole and olanzapine because they can cause hypotension. And benzodiazepines can also cause problems with hypotension with those two drugs. So that is something to be aware of. Pimazide is actually a little bit dirtier in terms of drug interactions, having interactions with macrolide antibiotics, citalopram and escitalopram, and sertraline, as well as inhibitors of CYP2D6 and 3A4, which is always, I always have to look those up. I don't know if anybody just has those memorized. And then the last thing that they kind of emphasize is sometimes it's really hard to get these patients to take a medication that's described as an antipsychotic. And that's been a barrier that I personally have encountered. So they talk about a little bit of scripting with how to get that medication actually started for that patient, you know, saying something along the lines to, you know, this medication will help eliminate the crawling sensations you're experiencing, or I want to focus on managing your symptoms and this medication will help. And they also sometimes add that, you know, medicines have many uses, such as doxepin is an antidepressant, but we sometimes use it as an antihistamine. Some of the drugs used in psychiatry can be useful to dermatologists. Right. So I think that that's some good scripting.
Naltrexone is for opioid
addiction. Yeah, naltrexone is for opioid addiction, but it helps with itching, you know.
So they say risperidone start at 0.5 milligrams and go up slowly.
Yeah, risperidone between 0.5 milligrams to 4 milligrams daily, with, you know, of course, monitoring for appropriate, you know, concerns of extrapyramidal side effects or Parkinsonism. My personal experience with this is it's been very, very difficult to get these patients, A, to see a psychiatrist, to agree to see one, and then B, to get them access to one has been very difficult.
Yep, so that's why we have to learn about risperidone.
That is a point they make in the article, that basically they found that only about 3% of dermatologists feel comfortable managing these medications. And I think one of the aims of the article is just to provide general information and hopefully to make the practicing dermatology population feel a little bit more comfortable with the possibility of using these drugs to help these patients that they truly are genuinely suffering. That's the thing I always try to remind myself of when I'm seeing a patient that has lesions of parasitosis, is that every day they're suffering with this and that they may be acting in a frustrating manner and they may be acting in a difficult way, and it may be really frustrating to try to take care of them, but their behavior is a symptom of their condition. And, you know, just like I wouldn't get mad at a patient that had high blood pressure for having hypertension, or patients that had diabetes for having a high blood sugar, you know, this manifestation of the behavior isn't something to let yourself get caught up in being upset about. So setting that kind of professional barrier between this is the result of their condition and I'm not going to take this personally has helped me to take care of these patients in a more compassionate way, but it is hard sometimes, especially in the middle of a busy clinic.
Challenging for sure, but all right. Good news. I did read this article like a day before I had a patient come in with delusional parasitosis, and then I started him on risperidone.
Ah, ta-da! So
I think he's supposed to come in a week or two, so we'll see how he's doing.
So no, it's 4%. No, I'm just kidding.
Uh-oh.
That's 4% of dermatologists that are comfortable. I'm just kidding.
Oh, yeah, right. There we go. And how many pediatric dermatologists?
Right? I'm very proud of you. See, you put your big boy pants on and you did that for the patient, and I appreciate you having this, having the strength of character to try to do that for the patient.
I keep my big boy pants in my office, so they're just down the hall if I need them.
That's a good idea. I just keep an extra pair of scrubs because, you know, cysts. But
right. I've been there. So that's what we got. I have wondered if we should include some kind of like little sign off, like a patient story or something amusing that happened or some interesting case we saw recently. And I don't know if we should or not, but I might as well tell a bit of a funny story about a patient I had with delusions of parasitosis. Caveat, of course, is that disease is not funny. But sometimes stories are funny, and if we don't keep laughing, then I think we'll go a little bit crazy ourselves. So this is a patient I saw with you, actually, in residency, Michelle.
Okay.
She had delusions of parasitosis, and she had brought in a bag of, skin scrapings and leavings and stuff like that. And I thought we did a pretty good job of building a patient-resident-physician relationship. At the end of clinic, I looked at the items she got under the microscope, and it was mostly things that I didn't know what they were, but they just looked like bits of fuzz or something. But then I found this piece that looked a little bit like a bug. So I said, Michelle, take a look at this. And you looked at it and said, oh yeah, that's half of a flea. So I was so excited to call the patient and tell her, yeah, there actually is something here. And I thought maybe that would also inspire her to get some treatment and stuff like that, and would reassure her that this wasn't all just in her head. So I called her up and I said, so I looked at those things and it shows there's a flea. And she said, no, this can't be fleas. That flea doesn't make any difference at all. We keep our furniture covered. So I was excited, but it didn't end up meaning anything.
Well, that's a really good point to bring up, because actually in the article they mentioned that many times one can find real insects or arthropods in the matchbox or samples, but they are typically innocent peri-domestic organisms. I have a story like that, actually, where the patient had brought Ziploc baggie full of her skin specimens, and there was a very obvious cockroach in the bag. And so, you know, she handed it to us, and we said, well, there is a cockroach in there. And she's like, oh, yeah, no, my daughter heard that I was collecting my bugs, and she wanted to help me. And so the daughter had found a bug and put it in the bag. So that's a point that this article makes too, is that, you know, these conditions don't just affect the patient, they affect those around them. And so if we can help even some of these patients, we're also helping their families and quite likely their coworkers and friends. And so, you know, I think that doing what we can for them with as much empathy as possible while setting protective barriers to boundaries to make sure that we are all, you know, whole and safe in our practices is a good thing to do. It's a mitzvah, as you'd say.
Awesome. All right, so in this demo episode, we talked about sentinel lymph node biopsy and melanoma. We talked about naltrexone and dermatology. We talked about atopic dermatitis and socioeconomic status. And we talked about delusions of parasitosis. We will talk to you guys next time.
Thanks for listening.
And that will do it for this bonus episode, demo episode number one. Hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to hear all of our episodes, bonus and otherwise, you may do so on your favorite podcasting app and also on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, where you can find links to all of the original articles as well as some of our favorite articles and some other goodies. It's also a good way to get in touch with us, as are our social media accounts. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are Dermosphere Podcast. Thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech Dermatology for lending us Michelle. And normally, Dermosphere comes at you every 2 weeks with a new episode discussing some of the latest research in clinical dermatology. So, we will see you then.